I am Dick Anderson. I am alcoholic. And I'm already getting emotionally unstable. I was sitting up here, and I think especially when we were talking about Keith, because Keith was my best friend, and 2 years ago, many of you heard me talk about being in a room with him when he left, and these are the rosary beads that he made for me, and I'm not Catholic. I don't even know what to do with them, but I carry them around. And everybody this weekend has been talking about what others have shared, and it really is like being in a place where you're just surrounded in a warm blanket with all the people that are here, but we're all passing along things that we've heard from other people. I heard when I had got to this program and I was in pretty bad shape. I had DTs for 4 or 5 days, and after the DTs stopped, they brought me out into a little room in my robe and slippers and played a tape. And I thought I had ended my life. And the tape was of a guy who had just recorded this thing called Drop the Rock. His name was Sandy Beach, and he had just recorded that year. And all I heard was Marine Corps and idiot, so I related. If I'd heard the Yale part, there would have been some problems, but I would. I would never have thought that I would have been standing in a place where I'm one of, because I never was one of, and that's really the steps I'm going to talk about today. The eighth and ninth steps are the steps where we become one of. And the people that are on this program that I'm privileged to share, every one of them is somebody who has touched my life in a very personal and dramatic way, except for Father Tom. I'd never met him, and I only got to hear the second half yesterday, but it was terrific, and you ought to listen to the tapes. Wonderful sharing. But Ralph and I connected about 10 years ago in Amarillo, Texas. We've kind of gone upgrade since then. We were in Hawaii not too long ago, and now in Cocoa Beach. And Bob talked about being saved like I was by my sponsor at one point, John Holmes. And I got to know him actually through my sponsor before I ever heard him talk or before he ever knew that I was standing at a podium any place. And Tom and Sandy are two of the people that I look to, even when I'm not hearing what they're saying, but I watch what they do. Because for those of us, I'm coming up on 33 years. Oh, yeah, my sobriety date is June the 8th, 1977, and my home group is the Macklin Group at Powder Springs. But we need people that don't just retire from AA after a while, and you can't find people that work any harder than Sandy and Tom and Clancy and some of the people that we follow, and I've been following them for a long time, and we're very, very blessed to have them here. So I'm just grateful to be here. And where's Michael? Is she here? No. And Michael lives just over in Augusta, and a tremendous friend. And Polly and I, actually, I think where we first spoke together was here. So I've just been very moved today, and I wasn't emotional at all until I got up here, and then I just I started thinking about my friend Keith and what a wonderful man he was. So I just want to thank Lee, who has become a good friend and is a good friend to this program. He does a lot of work to help develop things and to work behind the scenes and to get things going so that we can listen to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's a very, very valuable person in my life, as are the men that I sponsor. And that's the gift of being able to sponsor somebody like John. If you haven't heard his story, it's terrific. And Ray was around here a little while ago, and Cap, he sponsors. And so I just feel very grateful for everything that's going on. I'd like to thank Bob. For some of you who don't know, we started another one of these Woodstocks up in Callaway Gardens last year, and everybody who's here plus a couple are going to be there in December. So I don't think you can get too many of those, but if you get a chance to come, there's some flyers over there. But the first one was started by Bob Darrell, who spoke here earlier, and out at Stateline, and I've been privileged to go out there. And then Lee, we pass it on. Lee found it and brought it here, and I was able to be part of that 2 years ago, and it set me on fire so much that we decided to start one further north in the south, about 8-9 hours north of here at Callaway Gardens, and now there's going to be one in Maryland, and I think there'll probably be one in the Midwest, and I just think they're great. When I first got sober, I went to nothing but speaker meetings. I had all speaker meetings, and then after a little while, they got me involved in a big book meeting and a 12 and 12 meeting. And I don't think there's a more powerful way to convey the power and the process of this program than a speaker meeting. And it's also the way you can identify, and from one end to the other, it does everything that needs to be done in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And kind of the interesting thing about this format is it does exactly the same thing. You walk all the way through the steps, except you're hearing it instead of one person's story, you're hearing it for several people sharing from their heart their own experience, so you get kind of a unified conglomerate of how this whole thing works with a lot of different perspectives, and I think that's what's so great about it. It was a simple idea. You know, it's one of those things, well, I could have thought of that, but it was a simple idea, but Bob started it, and Lee, and now we've got several of them going, so I hope that that you bring other people to those that are here in the future. Eighth step, we made a list. I'm not going to say much about the eighth step. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Both Ralph and Bob did a wonderful job this morning talking about how you put people on the list, how you select people to go on that list. So what they said, I can't really add anything to that, except that because I was telling the nature of my wrongs in my fifth step, I left a few people out. And I don't mean that I meant to, but I left a few people out. So when it came time for me to do my eighth step, I spent a great deal of time trying to see who else I could add to the list. Now, having said that, what this step does, the eighth and ninth step, is in the big book, it talks about bringing us back into a relationship with people and God, which is what was missing all my life. In the 12 and 12, it talks more about it bringing us back into relations with people. But in my case, it did as much for bringing me into a relationship with God as anything that I did. And I'll share some of that with you in a moment. But when I got here, here is who I presented to you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been separated from both people and God for a long time. I grew up in a family of, last night we had on the back, I'm kind of a TV generation guy, and God speaks to me through TV. That's the truth. That's the truth. Movies and TV, that's where I get my message. You guys go someplace else, I go there. Last night there was that Ken Burns special on the Civil War. And it was on, and it got to Antietam. And it mentions my great-grandfather, for whom I'm named, because he was a hero at Antietam. And his grandfather was a hero at Valley Forge and was the first guy. And they're all named Richard Anderson, same name as me. Well, except that everybody called them Dick, and they called me Dick. Last night, or Thursday night, I felt so sorry for Polly, because Polly was talking about how as a child she had to suffer through being called Polly, Polly Waddle Doodle, Polly Want a Cracker. My name is Dick. And so... Poor Polly. And if you look in the history books, my great-grandfather's, his nickname, he served under Robert E. Lee as a three-star general, was Fighting Dick. Fighting Dick Anderson. So I kind of think that it didn't have the same connotation back in the old days that it does now, but... whatever. So that's the family I grew up in, and you don't have to know me very long to know that I'm not noble, and I'm not. I served a couple of tours. I went to Vietnam, but I'm not like them. They're, it was like growing up in a family of eagles, and I'm a penguin. And a penguin is, I think, is an interesting bird. I mean, I think they're kind of neat. They're fun. They seem very social and affable and all that, but they're very different than an eagle. And so I felt like I didn't fit in. And that was from the very beginning. So now, no matter what I did, I felt separated. Nothing bad happened to me. But I felt separated. And I felt ill at ease in everything that I did. And I thought maybe my family was very faith-filled. If I heard the story of Stonewall Jackson once, I heard it a dozen times, and the reason he was a Stonewall was because he believed we do what we're supposed to do, and if we're doing it, when it's time for God to take us home, he will, and otherwise we don't need to worry. We don't need to have fear. And so he stood up like a Stonewall, and his men saw him, and they would follow behind him. I heard that story many times, and my family, they prayed. They were faithful. Filled warriors. They didn't go to the VFW. There wasn't much drinking thing. So I just didn't fit in with that group very well, and still am different than they are. When we go back, Barbara will tell you, we go back, I'm still kind of the odd guy out. I mean, they love me, I love them, but I am different than they are. And so I felt like I didn't fit in. But I felt like there was this thing about God, and if I could find the connection with God, that would make me feel whole. That would make me like them. That would give me the power that they had, because I heard about God's power. I heard about it all the time. We went to a church where they talked about God's power a great deal, and they talked about it in Sunday school. And so I tried. I told you I love TV. Now, my first time I saw anything in color was when I went to see the drive-in, and I was about 6 or 7 years old, and we saw this movie. The big book says, lack of power is our dilemma. It is the purpose of this book to connect me with a power greater than myself. And so, but that's the way I felt. I had this lack of power. Now, maybe I can get this power if I connect with God. Then I can fit in with the family and other people, too. But I went to the drive-in, and there was this movie up there, and I'd never seen color, and it was not only in color, it was in Technicolor, and it was 120 feet wide, and it was nothing but power. It was the story of the Ten Commandments. And up there was a man named Moses, and he had a staff, and he would push it to one side, and suddenly the Red Sea would part. And I made two decisions that night. I said, I want to do whatever that is up there. And I've made a living, or not made a living, but I've been working in the field of writing and producing my entire adult life. And God heard me, and God put me around then. But I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know God was listening to me. But the second decision I made was I wanted to be on God's side, because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so the next day, I went down Linda Baptist Church and got dipped and dunked, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 56 Ford. And so I was back there with my little sister, who's now a retired colonel. And so, they're all eagles. And so I go down the next day. I've got this thing. I go down the aisle, and they were playing I Surrender All or We Surrender All, whatever it is. They're surrendering something. And so I'm going down the aisle, and I surrender all of me. I'm about 4'6", all of me. And I go through the whole thing. My parents say, we didn't even know he was, interested. And I go down. I have this thing, and it was an emotional experience, and there was somewhat of an intellectual experience, and I wanted very badly to have this. But I still felt separated and apart and alone, and I didn't have a sponsor. One of the greatest gifts of AA is that we have a sponsor. There's a guy named John in Hilton Head who knows everything about me, good and bad, and accepts me exactly as I am and works with me. I just got off the phone with him at lunch. He told me he loved me. He knows how I am, but he told me he loved me. And so, we don't have that. And when you walk into church, you're afraid to tell somebody that you don't know what's going on and you have no clue what's happening. So I did, like a lot of people that come into AA, I did nothing. I just went. I attended meetings, the don't drink and go to meetings thing, and nothing changed because I wasn't taking any action to change. And because of that, after a few days, weeks, whatever it was, I still had all that. I was still that scared little Baptist Boy Scout. And so I felt like because I could see you smiling, I could see you getting up and talking to people, and I felt like God loved you, and he had picked you, because I'd heard there were chosen ones. And I figured I was one of the people that was not chosen. No, really. I mean, you never know what a kid thinks when they hear something when they're 6 or 7. I thought you were chosen, I wasn't chosen. Now, I don't fit in with God, I don't fit in with you. And that's a pretty lonely place for somebody like that to be. So I began acting. You've heard a lot, Bob and Ralph, everybody's today talking about acting in their own life. I was an actor in my life, and I got to be very good at acting in my life. And I was played all kinds of roles in my life. And I went to school. I made good grades. I made 1680s on the SAT. So that was when I was a freshman. By the time I was a senior, I had my uncle help me get into UK, but I could have gotten into Brown or Harvard or wherever. And but I played football, I played other sports, I did all these things, but I did them because I was supposed to do them, not because I wanted to do them, not because I felt like I was part of anything. And I just felt like I was starting quarterback on our football team, and all the rest of the guys were really enthusiastic about winning. I really just wanted, there was a cheerleader over there that I wanted to see me because I wanted to go out with her, and that's why I did that. I just did things because I wanted to be noticed, because I wanted somebody to accept me. And I went through life that way, and I did a good enough job that some people thought that I was, my parents thought I was a happy child, they said. And that's the way I lived. Until I had my first spiritual experience of a distilled nature, and that was when I was 14 years old. Another buddy and I were going to go to the drive-in. We were going to play Babe Ruth League baseball the next day, and he got a six-pack of beer and a half pint of gin, and I drank the beer, he drank the gin, and I felt like what I thought Moses must have felt like when the wind was blowing through his hair and he had the staff to one side, because suddenly I just felt like there was no fear. I was standing straight up, and we went up to a place called the White Castle, and we were there at midnight, and my buddy was not having the same spiritual experience I was, so he was getting a little woozy. I ordered him a cup of coffee. I hadn't had a cup of coffee, but I'd seen him Perry Mason, where if you have too much to drink, you have a cup of coffee and it sobers you up so you can talk to the police. And so, which is going to come in handy in just a second. And so so he got the coffee and he threw up down the counter. And the next thing you know, if you're looking for it. Now, see, I was having a great time. I was always shy, but now, feeling this, I was in there. There was a redhead behind the counter that I think had her eye on me. I was table hopping with adults, and it was midnight. We were having a great time, and if you're looking for Louisville City policemen at midnight, the best place to find them is at the White Castle. So they came down, said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "Nothing. My friend just had too much to drink." "Really? How old is he?" "14. How old are you?" "14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, this kid who came from a family of honor, we've got, I think, 11 West Point graduates and 4 Annapolis graduates, all Marines and Army, and this family that I come from, and nobody had been arrested. There were no alcoholics of record that I know of, and I broke the barrier on both, but I had been arrested 22 times, and I had been arrested 22 times only once. Was I arrested for a DUI. All the rest of the times were for defiance. And we were talking about humility earlier, and I don't know exactly how to explain humility, but I know humility, the opposite of humility, is defiance. Humility is where I seek God's will, and I believe, and I use what gifts he's given me to be useful to you. But defiance is where nobody's going to tell me what to do, and I'm going to do it my way. And I was defiant. I was very defiant. I was the guy, if you were pulled aside, if you were my buddy and you were over on the side of the road and a state trooper had you pulled there, I pulled in behind him and said, "What's the problem, officer?" My buddies loved me because they got to go home and I was the one in handcuffs when the whole thing was through. But that's who came to you. By the time I got here, the only thing that would beat me down, because I had no place to go, I didn't remember a relationship with God, and I felt isolated from my parents, so I had no warm, fuzzy place to go. There was no place to go back to. So I kept going, and alcohol was the only thing that worked for me, and I drank until I could not drink anymore. My last 2 years of drinking, I bled from the esophagus. I had brain damage when I got here. I was hearing things coming out of the heating vents for the last 2 years. I did not eat any food for the last 2 years. All I did was survive on whiskey. I slept on a bathroom floor. I had a little black and white TV where I'd watch old movies. I'd get up, I'd dry heave, get a drink down, and drink till I passed out on that bathroom floor. And then eventually got evicted, and I got here because I cried out to God rather than put a bullet in my head. That's who you had. So when I came in here, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not read. It took me over a year to learn how to read. I was confused. And as you can tell, I'm still emotionally unstable, but back then I would cry at the wrong places and I would laugh at the wrong places. The first time Clancy spoke in our area, they kept me way in the back so I wouldn't be cast out. And so, but because I was inappropriate. I wasn't inappropriate like touching people. I don't mean that. I was just inappropriate nuts. And so, but that's what they had to deal with. Now, honestly, here's how they kept me sober in the beginning. I worked through three. They told me that the only way for me to get sober was trust God and clean house. So the guys that I got sober, and my sponsor was an old railroad man named Jack from Louisville, Kentucky, and they worked through the steps. I couldn't remember anything. So I couldn't. I only had one resentment on my first three inventories that I did. And so with that, you know that there wasn't much that I had to do. There wasn't much that I could do because I couldn't remember anything. It was well over a year before I was able to talk or anything. Now, I had been searching. This is the strange thing. I had been searching all my life for this relationship with this power, for some purpose in my life, to find out what I was here for. I had read growing up a lot of the normal writers, the Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all that, but I went through a period. And I did graduate work in intercultural studies, and I was reading everybody from Thomas Merton to Jack Kerouac to Herman Hesse, Ken Kesey, The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, Edgar Casey. Edgar Casey was my dad's hometown in Hopkinsville, and he would read and absorb a book, and so I would read. I'd be drinking, but I'd read with a book underneath, and it didn't work. I mean, I was going to any length to try to find God, but I didn't know how to find it. And I was doing all of it up here. Every practice that I had to find this connection with God was with my mind. And it seems really strange to me that what this was a gift that I was given when I got here. What God did for me is he presented me to you in a teachable form. Because when I came in here, surrendered to you, I mean, and I had read the Torah, the Bible, the Quran. There's not anything that I hadn't tried to do to study to try to be connected to God. What it took for me to be connected to God was to be brought to you with no ideas of my own, where I could barely get around, where I was considered to be, you know, kind of addled-brained, and they made me the ashtray guy for my home group, and I stayed in somebody's basement, and one of the old-timers had a basement where he had two cots, and I would stay in one. I'd stay up. We didn't have a treatment center. I'd stay up at night helping new drunks, and I'd help them throw up and help them get over the shakes and all that. That was the way God introduced me to how to love people. And if there's anything that I really miss about the early days of AA for me, not the early days of AA, but the early days of AA for me, it's working with wet drunks. Because even if you got 2 weeks, they're worse than you are because they're still shaking. And you're staying up with them, and they've got the DTs, and you help them, and they're pulling their hair out, and they're doing all that. And that's how I stayed sober, plus being the ashtray guy at my home group. They wouldn't let me do anything that required math, like making the coffee. And so so I got here. Now, I was attending, after a while, a book, a big book meeting. And it was in a 12 and 12 meeting. And, you know, and I'm glad that I wasn't able to read this at first, but I'm going to read a few of the things about the eighth and ninth step that are my favorite quotes in here in the big book period. But the first one, this is not one of my favorite, but it's one that says, and it explains why I couldn't understand anything for a couple of years. Well, perhaps there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Now, how many people in here have been feeling diffident in the last couple of days? How many people here belong to a group called We Are Diffident? How many people here honestly actually know what the word diffident means? There you go. All right. Diffident means lacking confidence in one's own ability, worth, or fitness. Timid, shy, restrained or reserved in manner, distrustful. So I'm a little wobbly on my feet. That's where I was. And that diffidence apparently comes from the fact that I'm just full of everything. And I've been making things up so long that I'm afraid you're going to find me out. And that's what we've been talking about the whole weekend. Now, I've done the steps as best I could. After I was sober for about a year and a half, suddenly my mind starts to work, and I went through, and I start writing down things, and I was telling the guy, I said, I haven't been able to think of anything to put on this amends list, and all of a sudden, I am resentful and hateful at everybody. Everybody I know, my parents, the people that I grew up with, my family, all my friends, women that I had gone after and not been able to get, or that I'd broken up with. I was engaged 6 times, and men who got the women that, and on. There was nobody that I was happy with. I was angry at everybody. I had a chip on my shoulder about everything. And so I you can't go through the life that way and have any kind of peace at all. So I was at odds with everybody, and I wrote those things down. And I was scared to death when I did my fifth step because I had to admit to a God, and most of all, and the one on the list that was the most important to me, because I'm going to share that in my amends, was God. I was angry that God chose other people and didn't choose me. And at every place where I saw what I thought was God in somebody's life, it just made me angrier and angrier and angrier. And, you hear about these people who burn down a church, or they do these things because they're angry at people who have a relationship with God. And that was the way I was. And it took me a long, long time before I could recognize that. And when I finally did it, and I did it on a fifth step, I was scared to death because the guy I was doing the fifth step with pulled out a bookmark that had a picture of the particular God that I had been worshiping or angry at. Not worshiping, it's a little different. Now, I was told to ask God in the morning to keep me sober and thank God in the afternoon. And I did exactly that. And I have not had a desire for a drink since I got here. So at some point, because it was pointed out to me because God was doing that for me, I thought, well, maybe I'll start to give God a chance. And I was praying and thanking. But I did not want God in the same room with me when I was doing hardly anything. I did not want conscious contact. And so this was my difficulty, even more so than people. And so I ended up finally walking through, making my list, and the only thing that I'll tell you about the list was that I just specifically outlined each one of them, and I had some where I had nature, and it would help me to remember that I had done a similar thing to 2 or 3 other people. That's all I can tell you about the list. I don't think there's any trick to that if you've done a good fourth step. But now I get to the 9th step, and part of the 8th step is planning on what I'm going to do in the 9th step. And this is the one step that I would say above all others requires adult supervision. This is the one step where you can go, and without supervision, you can create more damage than you had in the first place. And I will share, because I didn't do them as badly as some of my friends, but one of the guys who was in the home group with me was a guy named Warner. And Warner could not get through the 9th step because there were certain people he did not want to forgive. And shortly after our first birthday, and we celebrated our first birthday together, Warner came to a meeting drunk. He was the first one of the guys that I got sober with that really worked the program that I saw drunk. And it scared me to death. And within 2 weeks, he'd shot himself in the head. And he was dead. Because he could not work through a 9th step. We had another guy who decided to do a lot of this without talking to his sponsor. And he owed a bookie down on Frankfort Avenue in Louisville some money. So he went in there to repay the money and hadn't talked to his sponsor, and he got shot. He didn't die, but did go to a sponsor after that. And you know, sometimes we learn through pain. And so we had a guy that I sponsored. I had helped start a place. This was probably 10, 11 years sober, and I'd helped start a place, move back to Atlanta, and by this time Barbara and I are married, and it started a place where we took in people that couldn't afford to go anyplace else. It was a treatment center for people who just couldn't afford, and we funded it other ways. And this guy was a guy I absolutely loved. He was just so charming, but he was a diamond in the rough. I found him looking under bushes downtown trying to find his false teeth. And he was a street drunk who had lost his teeth. I don't know where he was going. He wasn't taking them with him. But he had lost his teeth, and we got him in, and this guy just ended up being one of the best members in the world. And Barbara was, he ended up getting married 2 or 3 years later. Barbara was the maid of honor. I was the best man. And he married an Al-Anon friend of hers, and just everybody loved him, and he was good at fixing things and so forth, and a fairly big guy. And I did the fifth step with him. And this guy had worked for organized crime down in Louisiana, and he had been a muscle man. And he had, and he did not think he owed any amends, because he had actually shot people, killed them for his boss. He had kidnapped girls from malls to take them down to the brothels, all this stuff. But he said, that's business. Because he grew up from the time he was 3 or 4, adopted by these people. He was a street kid himself and was adopted by these people. And we get used to the misery that we live in, and we think that's okay. And he thought that was business. That wasn't something he owed any amends for. And it wasn't that long after he got married, and I sat down with him, and I said, I will go with you to make amends, because if you don't make them soon, you're either going to bolt and leave, or you're going to get drunk. And a couple weeks later, he was gone. He married that girl, and he was gone. She never saw him again. And we found out he'd gone back to the people he worked for down there, but once he got back down there, because once you see some sunlight of the Spirit, it's very difficult to go back and live in darkness again. And he couldn't really do it, and he started drinking, and they don't like it when you're drunk all the time, when you're working a place where secrets are important. And they killed him and dropped his body off in the bayou because he couldn't get through it. My most recent, one of my grand pigeons, a guy, and this guy sponsored him in my home group. And he was very bright and didn't have all the physical problems that some of us had coming in. He was an attorney and thought he knew better. And he ended up, in his case, he was going to a therapist at the same time he was coming to us. So my pigeon comes to me and says, I got a problem. I got this guy a sponsor, and his therapist is telling him to go ahead and tell his wife and the people at work everything that he's done. And so we sat down with him, and we advised, as, you know, you can't beat somebody up, and, well, you could, but it's not a good idea, and tell them they can't go someplace. But I suggested, as strongly as I can make a suggestion, that's not a good idea, and here's our experience, and here's why. And he didn't listen, and the next meeting I saw him, and he was living an extended stay. His wife was divorcing him, and I try to be sincere, but sometimes it's difficult. And I just went by and I said, well, why don't you go ahead and share everything with your law firm, and that way you'll just be absolutely free to go to meetings all the time. So, he had a therapist who helped him get drunk. I hope he'll get back here, but he's been drunk for about a year and a half, and he's been gone for a year and a half. This is a life and death disease, and these are life and death steps. But now I want to share with you the good stuff. This is what happens when I started working mine, and I'm just sharing my experience. The first thing that I found was, as I was into it, I found my real purpose. The purpose of this book is to connect me with God. Our purpose, we've talked about that today, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others achieve sobriety. But my personal purpose is listed in here and into action on page 77. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That does not say people in AA. That does not say just Al-Anons and AAs. That does not say just people I like, people. It means everybody that I come into contact with. And that's what John was talking about earlier. I had been very single-minded for a long time in AA, where I thought my whole job was just to go diagnose everybody's alcoholism and help them get sober. And that is a joy and a grand joy. But I have to be a husband. I have to be. I have some work to do. I have other things. I have friends. I have people that I know that don't have the disease of alcoholism that may need encouragement or may need prayer or may need somebody to help love them. This gives me a very specific purpose. All my life, I've been looking for a purpose, and I've been looking for a relationship with God. Now, the problem with that is I still don't have a relationship with God, and that's the difficult part. In here, it's real clear about what I have to be willing to do. It says, we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Over here, it says, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be, even if I go to jail. We may lose our position or reputation or face job, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink for anything. And if we actually do this, and this is the biggest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, there are a few shy people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd say 90% of the people in AA are chatterboxes. We all like to talk. And this says, a remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. And that was not an easy lesson for me to learn, because everything I knew about spirituality was up here in my head and was talking about it and was sharing ideas and everything else. Now I have to walk back through all these traps that I've built in my life, all these places where I've injured people, my family, everybody I ever worked with. I got fired from the last 6 jobs I had when I was drinking. I have been arrested 22 times. In all of these, I've been engaged 6 times. And those don't even count the people that I didn't even know that I would try to cut off in traffic or yell and scream at or do whatever I was doing. I took out my anger on people who had to listen to me, who were waiters or service people. So one of the first amends I made was because it was financial. That seemed to be easier for me to get my head around, was the financial stuff. I went to this agency that I'd worked for, which was the biggest agency in the world, and I went to the comptroller, whose name was Hartmus. It was the Atlanta office where they finally let me go. That's an old Southern name. And we called her Heartless because she was so tough on everybody on our expense account. And I went in. I didn't really have anything when I got to AA, but I had gotten, I think, a watch by that time. I purposely didn't take the watch because I thought I might be going to prison. And so I walked in, and I said, I stole on my expense account, and I probably padded $50,000. Now, this is 32 years ago. I did most of my creative writing on the expense account because I never ate. I told you I didn't eat, and I had some expensive meals. And I said, I probably owe $50,000. And I was expecting for her to talk to me about what legal action needed to be taken. I said, and I don't have the money to pay that back, and it's such a big amount that I don't think I can pay it anytime soon. I just want you to know that I'm willing to do whatever you want me to do. And she started crying. And she said, did you know that there were a group of people here who knew you were in trouble and we had been praying for you? And suddenly we realized that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. This was an ad agency with a bunch of people who, if there was a moral person there, I didn't know him. Of course, I wasn't hanging out with Hartmus. We were all sleeping with each other. This was this was when discos were just starting, thankfully I got sober before I had to buy a leisure suit. But it was that's something I don't know how you would make amends for that. But she said, It would take us. It would be more harmful to this company for us to correct that at this point. And this company is very profitable. And you did a good job when you were here. So why don't you consider that forgiven? And by the way, and this was in Atlanta when I was starting to move back down there. She said, if you need a place to stay, you can stay in my carriage house. I had spent much of my time beating up God. You know, I know he was worried about me, but I was maligning people, telling people what hypocrites Christians were. Catholics were the worst, but Baptists were a second. And I'd go around and I'd tell everybody about how bad they were, etc., because, you know, if you don't get to join the club, then you tell everybody what a rotten club it is. And that's the way I felt. So I was telling everybody about that, and my sponsor said, well, you need to go back to that church when you were a kid, and all these churches, and you need to make amends to them. And he explained to me, amends is not apologizing. If you just apologize, that's shallow. Amends is amending, changing what I did. If I broke a guy's window, I have to replace the window. If I puked on his rug, I have to get him a new rug because he probably doesn't want it secondhand cleaned. If I, whatever it is, I have to come up with something. And that's where my sponsor helped me on all of these things. But this I thought was not one of his better ideas, but I did it anyway. He said, you need to go there and ask if you can face the congregation and tell them what you have done and ask them forgiveness and ask if you can stay there to volunteer to work for a while to make amends. So I go to this Baptist church on a Sunday night. And I get up and I tell them this story and I make amends and I ask them if I can stay there for a while. And two things happened that I wasn't expecting. One, I was already comfortable with you. I was comfortable in AA by this time. But I wasn't comfortable outside of AA. There were a whole group of people in that church that loved me unconditionally, just like you do. And that, I was still struggling. And that Christmas, they gave me money to go home and see my parents in Mississippi. And they took care of me. And suddenly the walls were coming down because I realized if I was a child of God, I was not only a child of God in AA, but every place. The second thing that happened, I was probably 2 years sober by that time. My sponsor said I could date. I was trying a couple of girls in the program. That wasn't going too well. And, you know, first date, you're absolutely in love. Second date, you're in love, but you're seeing a couple of character defects in her. By the third date, you're trying to figure out how you can go to different meetings and not run into each other. So I was looking for a significant other, a partner, somebody to boom boom with. And so I'm in there. I'm not looking for that at a Baptist church. And so that night at Linden Baptist Church, there was this beautiful blonde. And she had never heard anybody apologize to a Baptist church before or since. And and she was not who I would have picked out. I was looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. And she was a seminary student and a good girl. And I had never known a good girl. And that girl and I had been married 26 years, and she's my wife. Barbara, stand up. So I sponsor guys. I say, if you want to meet somebody, you're going to, more likely to meet the person that's going to be your soulmate for the rest of your life on a ninth step than you are on a 13th step. And I'm convinced if I had done the picking, I would not be married all this time. And it turned out Barbara needed Al-Anon, and she didn't know that, but it saved her life. And the point is, in all of this, suddenly you, slowly, not suddenly, because I'm not real quick, but slowly you start seeing how, after the fact, how God used just me working that step with that church to give me any number of blessings, including a wife. I go to another church that was the last church I'd been a member of, and it was the church where my 89-year-old dad got remarried last year. My wife and I, my mom died 5 years ago, and my dad married a younger woman. She's 78. And but she's active. She plays tennis, and they got married there, but that's where they were going to church. It's a Scottish family, so they're Presbyterian, So I go back in, and I'm trying to find somebody to apologize. Now, this place I'd actually defaced. I don't know what I'd written, but it wasn't nice. And it was stuff on the So I go in there. I can't find anybody in the office. I can't find anybody any place. I go through the entire building. I go to the chapel, and I cannot find anybody. And I had been doing a lot of amends by this time, and suddenly I realize what I'm there for. If I had been honest, number one on my list of resentments, which was not number one, was God. Because I just absolutely, this vengeful God that I heard about, there was nothing that I really had more resentment towards than that God. And while I know now that God didn't do anything to deserve forgiveness, it was important. It says we should forgive them all. It was important for me to forgive God. So I got down on my knees and I started praying and I just said, and I started forgiving God. And I brought up everything in my mind that I thought God might have done. And I brought everything up and I forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you. And suddenly I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences. Most of the spiritual knowledge I have is seeing the evidence of God working in my life, but some of them are very direct, and this was one of those that was direct, and it was like there was this breeze flowing through my body, and my body felt like it weighed nothing, and there was a light in the room, and suddenly I realized that I was in the presence of a kind and loving God because I felt this sense of joy. And all this, what Sandy had talked about, the rock on your back, it was gone. Now, I had to go there, but God took it. And from that day until now, I have not had a knot in my stomach that made me feel like it was going to control me and take me across the room and tell me what I was going to do. And so I started to have this spiritual awakening that they talk about. I go to... And I told you, if I didn't like the Baptists, I really didn't like the Catholics. And I was invited to go to a thing at Gethsemane, which is a place, and I'd been reading Thomas Merton, but I go down to Gethsemane, and we're going to be down there for 2 days with no TV and no, you know, all this stuff. They want it to be quiet, all the things that I just did not like. And I go down there to Gethsemane, and I'm starting to be teachable, and a priest comes out, and a lot of these guys were Catholic. We did communion, except he wouldn't even let any of them have wine because we're all alcoholics, so I didn't understand that part. But anyway, I think he understood that part. And so, and this guy comes out, this little cocky Irish priest, and he says, and I had been looking so hard for God's will. I'd been praying for God's will because you told me to pray for God's will, only for God's will. And he comes out and says, you boys know what God's will is? And there were 12, 15. Nobody ventured to guess. And some of these were old-timers. And he said, God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can right now with what you've got to be useful to someone else. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a son, be a good son. If you are a member of AA and God got you sober there, be the best member of AA you can possibly be. If you are someone who loves their profession and you enjoy your job, do it honorably and love people through that job until you get something else, until he gives you something else to do. If you are somebody who hates your job, do it honorably and love people through that job until God gives you something else. He said, God sees us as we see our children. And if you men had two boys, and they were both 7 years old, and you gave both of them a little red wagon, and one of them took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy to the other kids, and the other kid took the red wagon and kicked it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And I had always been the one who kicked whatever I had aside and wanted something else. It never occurred to me, this is 180 degrees opposite than the way I think, it never occurred to me that my job was to take what you gave me right now and use it for other people, because how would that make me happy? It didn't occur to me. But what I found when I started to do that was something bigger than happiness. It's called joy. It's the feeling like I fit in, I have a purpose, I belong here, I can contribute something. I started to have this feeling like I was a child of God, and now I can go back to my parents, now I can go back to other people, I can be a member of my family. And that was so simple. But I had to be ready to hear it, and God, in his humoristic way, used a Catholic priest to tell me. And so, but that changed my life. Now, there are many amends, many other amends. You know, if you're ready and if you're willing, they will happen. I had been arrested 22 times. Now, how do you find a one-to-one to apologize to 22 when, first of all, it never was one-to-one. It was usually two-to-one, three-to-one. I was arrested for assault and battery on a police officer, two counts, at my senior prom, just having fun. And so two felony counts. I'm over 18. And so I am now, I don't know how to make amends. I don't know how to make amends to any of these people. How would you make amends? My sponsor couldn't even tell me how to make amends on that because I couldn't figure out who all the police were. I mean, they don't, the juvie stuff, they didn't have records. The other stuff, he said, do you really want to go in there? And because I had, the assault and battery charges were filed away. That means they could bring them back out if they wanted to, and I could have gone to prison, which I didn't really want to do. And so, so how do you make amends? My first year and a half while I was brain dead, I was the coffee guy. I was the ashtray guy. I poured coffee at a clubhouse, and I made enough money to pay for cigarettes. One of the old timers let me live in his basement, and I worked with the new drunks. That was my life. I didn't need anything else. They took me to meetings. They took me to conferences. They paid for everything for me. You know, they gave me everything, and I'm very grateful for that. I wasn't as grateful then as I am now. That's the truth. I'm a lot more grateful now for things that people gave me. So how am I going to solve this problem? Now, when my brain starts working, there was an old-timers luncheon at the Galt House in Louisville, Kentucky, and it was Mike England, Carter Redding. These are all guys that you guys may know, Carter Redding and Jack Sullivan and all of them. They're all down there, and I'm the young time. They come let me hang out. It's like Chris is getting to hang out with Sandy for the last 8-9 years, and you won't. That's an incredible gift. And they let me hang out with them, and I was down there. And they're all talking. If you've ever heard old-timers, they don't seem to catch the sense of urgency of our crises. And they were talking about somebody had just gotten a new Mercedes. Somebody else had gotten a new putter or a sand wedge. I don't know. I don't play golf. Wedge or something. Another guy had a condominium at Hilton Head. I had no idea what a condominium was. And so I'm just totally lost with this. And so they're in the middle of their pleasant conversation. I said, I need a job, and I need some money, and I need a place to stay. Oh, okay. And they go back to talking about whatever they're talking about, because this was not a meeting. It was a luncheon, you know. And I thought, well, they're not hearing me. And so afterwards, one of the guys, an attorney, says, he said, you worked for so-and-so, this agency, and I said, yes, I did. He said, well, why don't you bring your resume over tomorrow? Meet me at the office at 12 noon. By 12:15, I had a job, I had a place to stay, I had a car, I had a lot less money than I thought I needed, but exactly the right amount of money to keep me sober. I was doing the press and advertising for a guy who was running for mayor, and this guy was his finance chairman, and 6 weeks later, I was the press secretary for the mayor of Louisville and the director of public affairs for the city. I thought it was an improvement over the ashtray guy. So. You know, I didn't know what I was going to talk about when I got up here, but I said, God, make me grateful. Not this grateful. I'd forgotten about some of this stuff. Okay, so now I'm the press secretary. I know how to handle the press, except that I had about 10 AAs around me at all time, because you know how when you're 2 years sober, 3 years sober, whatever, you have a chance to explode every once in a while. Well, that doesn't work when you're press secretary. And so I had people around me kind of buffering me, making sure that I'd calm down when I'd do my job. And I was qualified. I was more than qualified. I'd worked for the Courier Journal there. I'd been a creative director for an ad agency. I knew what to do about that part of it. But we had another problem, and many of the 12-step calls I went on with Jack were, we were 12-stepping policemen, because if you got caught drinking before you retired and had a drinking problem, you got fired. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. You got fired. So all their buddies covered for the policemen, and they covered for the firemen. So Jack, who started the program at Allen & Railroad to help all the railroad people get sober, he said, why don't we start a program, an amnesty program there? I just happened to be in that office and go and talk to the mayor. And he said, do whatever you want. I go talk to the police chief, and he said, fine, do it. And they thought it was a good idea. So we started the first amnesty program for public safety for the policemen and firemen in Louisville. And the way it worked was the chief would call him in. The first guy was a guy, doesn't make any difference what his name was, but he had gotten locked up by Jefferson County Police. He was a Louisville City policeman, had run his cruiser into a Jefferson County car, drunk, got out, got in a fist fight with him, and he was kind of confused as to why they were locking him up. He said, I thought we're cops. So anyway, so he's in the chief's office. So I tell my story for about 10 minutes. And I over-dramatized it back then, and the chief loved it, though. He'd always get teary-eyed. Oh, it's a wonderful story. And then they tell the guy who they brought in, they said, okay, you can go with Dick to AA, or you can lose your retirement. Now, let me think. So surprisingly, all six of the first people joined our amnesty program. But the second person that we got, after he was sober for a year or 2 years, somewhere in that area, took over the program and handled it until he died a couple of years ago. Now, I was in the middle of that. I was the most brain dead and unaware of what was going on, but I was in the right position and God was able to be useful, and Jack actually engineered things, and I was just in that job. How I made amends to the police. Now, I had been very promiscuous. I went to college in the 60s, and not only did we have free love, but we had no big diseases that you couldn't get a shot for and take care of. I did not realize at the time how wonderful that era was. So I went from, and for you who grew up in this generation, we went from you had to be pinned to somebody before you could make out with them to suddenly everybody's having sex with each other. And well, not everybody, but I mean, but really, literally, so I participated, and I got to the point when I got here, I was very used to using people and loving things. And I used a lot of people. And I didn't date much for the first couple of years, and when I finally did date a girl, I was going to that Baptist church now every Sunday, and then I was dating this girl, and she and I were sleeping together on Saturday night, and I wanted her to go to church. She said, well, I don't want to go to church. I don't want to know we're sleeping together. And I said, oh, sure, they won't mind. And so then it occurred to me that maybe I should go talk to the pastor. Maybe I am doing something I'm not supposed to be doing. I don't know. And I went to him and talked to him and said, I don't know what to do with this. I said, I actually don't feel guilty about this, and I was just honest with him. Because in AA, I thought everybody was as honest outside of here as they are in AA. They're not. Sometimes you have to think about what you say before you say it. But anyway, so I go in, and I just love AA, and I love, you know, we tell everybody everything. So, but I go in, and I told the pastor, and I said, what should I do? And he said, well, let's pray about it. So we prayed, and we prayed in his house. And both of us were kneeling, and another one of these experiences happened where it was though there was, I didn't see a light or anything. I just sensed like there was the most powerful energy on the universe right there, and it was so powerful I was afraid of it. And it was awesome. And it was like this undulating vibration with just where it's there were no atoms, there was no nothing. I mean, my eyes were closed. I was just down, but there was no time, there was nothing. This was a power that was bigger than this entire universe. And then it went away, and I was scared. You know, there's a thing in there about the shepherds when, at Christmas time, they were sore afraid. And I never understood that. Now I understood it, because I was actually afraid of this. I was afraid to open my eyes. And I asked the pastor afterwards, I said, did you encounter? Yes. I said, well, what does that mean? He said, I don't know. Because he didn't know, because he was an honest guy. So 2 days later, I'm at the mall, and there are a couple of babes walking by, and I am sexualizing them and thinking about what might happen. And it occurs to me that I have worked all my life so I can become a child of God, and if I am a child of God, they are God's daughters. And when I went out in high school or college with the daughter of a man I knew and respected, I treated her with respect. If I didn't know the parents, that wasn't always the case. I don't respond well to thou shalt not and hit me and tell me all the things I'm not supposed to do. That's how God answered my prayer for lust. That every woman here is one of God's daughters and needs to be treated like that. And especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, where we get women who come in here and they're searching for a relationship with God, and that can be cut off, you can kill them if a predator comes after them. And I think it's up to us who've been around for a while to make sure that that doesn't happen in our groups. And that's, I don't need to editorialize, but that's a strong belief of mine. Now, I had been engaged to this one woman and almost married to her. I'd been engaged to six women, but this was a woman, the last woman I was very much in love with. I really did want to marry her. I was trying to settle down. It was after I came back from Vietnam, and I met her and through a Marine named Frank, who I hope is gotten sober by now. But anyway, he and his wife were friends with this woman, and I met her, and we dated for a long time, and we're going to get married. We just had to figure out what to do with her husband. And but I did manage to get her broken up from her husband, and he was an advance man for Nixon, who was running for election. And I did manage to get them broken up, and I was going to... We were about 3 weeks away from the wedding, and I was a daily drinker who was also a binge drinker on top of, and I went on a binge about 3 weeks out and didn't show up for a couple days, and she said, we need to cut this off, and we did. And she loved me very much. She came to see me once when I was drinking after that, after I was in New York and moved from there, and she couldn't stand to see me because I was literally like a street drunk who'd managed to get it together to go to work now and then in a studio. And she just couldn't stand to see me like that. And she was so angry at me. But I would just come into her life and go out. If any of you saw the film recently about Bill and Lois, where Bill just, every time Lois thought something was going to change, he'd come back in and just tear her heart out. That's the way I was with this girl. But I made amends to her, and I made amends to her the right way, because you're not going over and meeting with her and having a weekend. I made amends by doing the right thing. And because I did, I didn't think much would come of that. But a few years later, I got a phone call from her, and she was crying. And she had married a guy who I knew about him because he looked like me. People thought we were still, they said, y'all get back together? And I said, no, I thought we saw you out the other night. So I called her, and she said, yes, I'm dating somebody who looks like you, but he's responsible. So, so as it turned out, because she hadn't gone to Al-Anon, she married another one of us. But he just wasn't as far along as I was. And she called me about 5, 8, 10 years into my program and crying, and she said, he's going to lose his job. He's an engineer with this big company and blah, blah, and we've got one kid and another on the way, and I don't know what to do, and et cetera. And because I had made amends to her, and she saw what you had done in my life and what God had done in my life, she called me back. I got her set up. She was living in a different place in Delaware. I got her set up with some Al-Anons and AAs up there, and now he has 22 years sobriety. I knocked my dad down when I came back from Vietnam because he was between me and a drink, and I'd run out of alcohol. I was staying at their house, and he got between me. And my sister and my mother and my little brother watched as I knocked my dad down to get out the door. And he told me after that, I don't want ever anything to do with you. Now, he didn't stand by that because he was a good man. But I was estranged. But because you told me what to do, I started calling them every Sunday. I started sending cards. I started doing the right thing. And then when the time came, I would go over and show up at the house now and then and argue about politics, and then I'd leave. But anyway, I got better about that later on. But because I did that, when Barbara, the girl that I met making amends to the church, and I got married, because I had made amends to my dad, he was my best man. I was not there much. My dad made the statement that my sins of omission were sometimes worse than my sins of commission. Because as much as I destroyed things, my biggest thing was I wasn't there for anybody. I never showed up for anybody, for anything. The night that my mother's father died, I had come in and taken, I was 16 years old in high school, and I'd taken their car out, and I had it out all night drinking. And she couldn't find me, so she's got to worry about me in addition to her dad dying. And so I made a commitment to start being there. And so when my mom died, my family asked me to do to write the eulogy, because I had changed enough, because I had made amends. And because of that, when I make an AA commitment, I keep it. Barbara and I, during the last few years, I know on one occasion I had a problem with my inner ear. Well, I still have a problem with my ear, but they grounded me and I couldn't fly, and we were speaking in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and we only had 2 days, and we drove straight through for 48 hours and got there and spoke. In November of last year, they stopped letting big planes fly into Canada. Well, I don't know, but anyway, so I took, and I can't drive over big bridges because of my vertigo, so I took the bus, the Greyhound bus, on a 26-hour drive up to Toronto, and Butch picked me up, and we went over to Cornwall and spoke. Then I found out when we took the bus, there's a tunnel under the river at Detroit. We never even went across a bridge, so next time I'll drive, but anyway. But my point is, I show up. I go to funerals. I go to the hospitals when people are sick. And I am there when people need something, not because I have any answer, but because I wasn't there before, and by just being there, people appreciate it. And that paid off for us because of my behavior in that area when, in 2005, we lost 3 out of 4 parents. Barbara's mom and dad died a week apart from each other. My mom died shortly thereafter. We have no children. We put our 18-year-old Elkhound to sleep, and right in the middle of that, I was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And esophageal cancer is 99 point something fatal. Nobody survives it. And it's one of the big three. It's pancreatic and esophagus and liver cancer. And so through a series of miracles, we end up being directed to a hospital up in New York. And I've told the story before. And we get up there, and it wasn't the hospital we picked. It was a hospital that I had been going to, a hospital out in University of Southern California. They wouldn't take my insurance. Now they send me to this place in New York. I had been using the 23rd Psalm to just get by on. We go up there, and they send us to a place in Rochester, New York. The Southern California says our chief of surgery just went up there. We go up. We go in. We walk in the door to look at it in the chapel in letters that are 1.5 feet deep in gold. It says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The same prayer that I've been using just to carry me through this. We walked out into the lobby to see where God had taken us, and it was Strong Memorial Hospital. It was endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. These are the kind of details God works out. If I'm just trying to do the best I can, it's not in this area, but it's in another area. It says, "Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world." But I could never do that until I had broken down every one of those walls, until I had paid my bills, until I had gone to the people that I had offended, because I had in me something blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit so long as I carried that. That's the biggest reason that we do the ninth step. And here's what it ends on in the big book about the ninth step. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? They are being filled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we will work for them. This thought brings us to step 10, and that's Tom tomorrow morning. Thank you.